Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi there, and welcome to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to look at the defence plans for India in 1939 at the start of the Second World War. And I'm looking at Srinath Raghavan's India's War, The Making of Modern South Asia, 1939-45. An excellent read. I've referred to this before. And it's a book that shows how the narrative history of independence and the narrative history of India's Second World War intersect, which is, of course, they do. But there are a few titles other than perhaps Forgotten Armies and Forgotten Wars by Tim Harper and Christopher Bailey that do it as effectively as this. So in September 1939, not only was the Indian Army underprepared for war, but there had been precious little meaningful work gone into India's defence policy. There were competing and conflicting policies, and the British Empire in general was experiencing acute imperial overstretch. There were not the finances, the resources, or the manpower to go around. The generation of officers that had survived the First World War were not of the calibre in the interwar years that their predecessors had been. Probably a great many of the more talented ones had died during the war. And as a result, in the hill stations of India, there were very many army officers, bureaucrats and imperial planners who were of the kind of the time-serving variety, who like the whiskey soda stengers and long afternoons in remote circumstances, and this was not conducive to a robust imperial defence. So Srinath Raghavan writes: in September 1939, the 200,000-strong Indian Army was subject to three competing claims, those of internal security, external defence, and imperial duties. This had been the case for nearly half a century. Since the rebellion of 1857, internal security had been a central concern of military policy in India. In 1881, the government of India claimed that the Indian Army is required to maintain internal tranquility rather than for employment against external foes. As late as 1912, an Army in India committee, led by Field Marshal Nicholson, had identified the principal mission of the Army as maintaining internal security and tranquility. Although internal security took a back seat during the First World War, it soon returned to the fore. From 1917 to the early 1920s, there were numerous and repeated uprisings from Burma to the Punjab, all the way to Malabar. There was the development across India of a mass popular nationalism. The ingredients for the development of India as a nation state, or a series of nation states were there, and the First World War had been the crucible in which these passions had been intensified and had been articulated in clear political outcomes. And this meant that the British were facing much more significant problems in India than they had ever faced before. And it also meant that there was more likely to be intercommunal tensions and riots as competing nationalisms interacted. A demonstration of this problem was that along the northwest frontier, just prior to the start of the Second World War, the Indian Army was involved in putting down a revolt. So right on the eve of involvement in war with Nazi Germany, there were internal separatist, nationalist, tribal politics resulting in insurrection and unrest. And it was from the mid-19th century up until the mid-20th century, well, until 1939 at any rate, that military planners saw the threat to India coming from this region. This was the era of the Great Game, in which Russia and Britain fought one another in a fairly futile and fruitless espionage war along the northwest frontier into Afghanistan and into Persia, and it was thought that this might be the place for a Russian invasion of India. This period, from the late 1870s onwards really, the British Raj was obsessed with the idea that Russia, that had been developing and growing its, expanding its borders throughout the 19th century, might expand southwards. In large part, this was fantasy. An invasion of India was such a vast logistical undertaking that the Russian government was deeply unprepared for and incapable of. And the geographical challenges of crossing through Afghanistan were so huge that it was really almost a figment of the British imagination. It was certainly the stuff that made spy writers of the period very successful. The era of the Great Game was one in which commanders-in-chief of the forces in India, including Kitchener, for example, created something of a fantasy narrative. The signing of an alliance between Russia and Britain in 1907 didn't really dissipate fantasies that, or fears or anxieties that the British had that India might be threatened by Russia. And it was even during the period of the Russian Revolution when Russia ceases to be a functioning state in the world system and certainly ceases to be capable of projecting power beyond its borders in any meaningful way, that the British still believed that Russia was the key threat. I think there was obviously the fear as well that dangerous subversive ideas might cross through Afghanistan into India. Of course, those dangerous subversive ideas were already there in the guise of the various communist thinkers and intellectuals who had gone to form the Communist Party of India. So, because of the Nazi-Soviet Pact of August 1939, the fears of a Soviet invasion of India are dramatically revived. By 1939, the British are looking at Nazi Germany and the Soviet Union as coming as a package deal. The British proposed to prevent an invasion of India by meeting any Soviet army crossing to Afghanistan, actually in Afghanistan itself, to draw the line between Kabul and Kandahar. The Indian Army had been Britain's secret weapon in East Africa, the Middle East, and Asia since the 19th century, and certainly during the First World War. During the First World War, 1.4 million Indian soldiers served Britain on the Western Front, in North Africa, in Egypt, in Palestine, in Mesopotamia, and beyond, even serving in China. And the power that the Indian Army represented was not to be kind of underestimated. It was a key part of the maintenance of the British Empire. So to quote from Raghavan again, "The imperial commitments of the Indian Army were altogether more contentious. In the 19th century, India was the central strategic reservoir of the British Empire and was crucial to securing imperial interests throughout Asia and large patches of Africa. As popular parodists put it, we don't want to fight, but by jingo, if we do, we won't go to the front ourselves, but we'll send the mild Hindu." During the First World War, India's imperial commitments bloated enormously. The Raj supplied almost 1.5 million troops, nearly three-quarters of whom served in the Middle East. In 1920, Indian troops were still stationed in Iraq and Egypt, Palestine and the Persian Gulf, Aden and Cyprus, Burma and Malaya, North China and Hong Kong. India's subsequent unwillingness to provide troops on tap has led some historians to conclude that the government of India was not solicitous of imperial interests in the interwar years. This is misleading, for it overlooks the fact that the Raj discerned a range of interests of its own, not least strategic, in most of these parts. After all, they constituted the informal empire of the Raj. The central concern of the managers of this sub-imperial system mirrored that of the larger empire: how to work their system on the cheap. So that's an interesting point, that there appears to have been a sub-empire existing within the British Empire, the Empire of the Raj, which perhaps stretched from Egypt all the way through to Hong Kong. And this was the, you could think of it as the eastern portion of the British Empire, or the sort of the largely colonial, non-dominion part of the British Empire that is run from India. It's ultimately, obviously, run from London, but from Delhi, it's possible to deploy troops to put down uprisings in Malaya or Burma or Egypt or wherever they're needed. And an entire system of economic management, military management, diplomatic management of this eastern part of the empire runs fairly autonomously from Delhi. How this would be paid for was always an interesting matter. So Raghavan writes, "The wrangling between India and Britain over the question of financing the external ventures of the Indian Army had been carried on since the 1870s. In 1902, the Indian government had accepted the suggestion of the Royal Commission that it should bear financial responsibility for areas which contained its direct and substantial interests. These included the Suez Canal, Persia, the Persian Gulf, and Afghanistan. During the 1914-18 war, India not only bore a substantial cost in raising and deploying troops, but also made a generous gift to Britain by taking over some of its war debts worth £100 million, which unfortunately a drop in the ocean, really. India, as the Viceroy put it, was bled absolutely white by the war. But this also means that from the point of view of Indian military officers, of Indian members of the Congress Party, that India was effectively operating as its own regional great power.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Whilst also being a colony of Great Britain, and this is sort of something that is irreconcilable. This is something that really can only eventually be reconciled by a change in India's status, either to dominion or to being an independent state. The economic crises of the interwar years, particularly the 1920s, present a significant problem for the British Empire. No longer is there a pliant and cooperative India willing to become involved in the ventures of the British Empire, but there is a country that is far less willing to become involved in assuming wider commitments. The government of India, that was staffed by British mandarins, by and large was responsible for the management of the budget of that government, and couldn't simply justify doing things because Westminster would like it. There were British administrators to the Viceroy in India, along with Indian politicians, businessmen, army men, and Indian officials, who saw the expense to which India would have been put had Westminster had its way as being unacceptable. So there is this very interesting and perhaps sort of understated financial schism within the British Empire, and it's really one of the things that you see emerging in empires from time to time, which foretells their dissolution. What Indian officials were most keen to avoid was providing troops to permanently garrison bases across the empire. So there were agreements that emergency troops could be sent to Iraq, to the Persian oil fields, Singapore, and to Shanghai, but that the British would share the bill, and that the once the crisis was over, Indian troops would be able to return to India. Now, in 1919, when the Montagu-Chelmsford reforms were passed, granting India a legislative assembly, the assembly had no powers to decide on matters of defence, because that was considered to be an imperial matter. But they did have powers to decide on taxation, and this gave them an opportunity to veto some of the more onerous military commitments that India was likely to be put to. However, in 1921, the British government argued that the Indian Army should be placed directly under British control, so it should be passed through to the control of the British government. The Legislative Assembly obviously said this was a terrible idea, and that the Indian Army should not be used outside of India. It shouldn't be a kind of a regional bulldog for the British Empire in Asia. In 1938, London put pressure on the Viceroy in New Delhi to provide a reserve division for the British Empire, but that the cost be met by India. And the reason why the cost was to be passed on to India is, this is the 1930s, this is a period of economic retrenchment and cutbacks, and that any government that can find ways to keep costs off the balance sheet and to pass them on to somebody else is going to try to take that option. The Treasury was told, whatever the legal position might be, we are under a moral obligation to consult the legislature. in the event of a situation arising which rendered desirable the dispatch of troops from India to some other theatre of operations, and anyone who thought otherwise was living in a wholly unreal world. That's a very telling comment, a wholly unreal world. The Viceroy is essentially telling the British government that you are fantasists if you think that you can simply tell the Indian Army what to do and where to go, to leave India, to put down a revolt in the Middle East or something like that, and that will not cause you significant problems. Of course it will. Which is ironic, because a year later, the self-same Viceroy, Lord Linlithgow, takes India to war without the consultation of the Congress Party or any other of the main political players in India whatsoever. By 1935, the change in the world situation was becoming abundantly clear, particularly with the rise of Japan as a belligerent or potential belligerent to the East. Japan's gradual, bit-by-bit, piecemeal colonisation of China was starting to show show sort of Japanese intentions in Asia. And in 1932, the Chiefs of Staff warned the Committee of Imperial Defence that a war with Japan would place Britain's colonies in the Far East, Hong Kong and Singapore, in direct peril. These were very lightly defended, and the Imperial Defences had been organised around Singapore for some time. There was a podcast that, unfortunately, it was years ago, but if there's a search function, have a look for it, on the Singapore strategy. I'll talk a bit about that in a moment. If Singapore fell, then the coastline of India would be badly exposed, as would be Australia. When Yamashita, the Japanese general, seized Singapore in 1942, he said it was the centre of the fan, I think the pin at the centre of the fan of the British Empire. You take that out and the rest of the British Empire in Asia falls apart. The whole point of the Singapore strategy was to create an impregnable naval base there and to sail a fleet from Singapore to blockade Japan and to bring Japan to its knees using the kind of strategies that brought Germany to its knees navally during the First World War, to starve Japan into submission. It only really takes the Japanese to cross down the Malay Peninsula for that one not to work very well, as subsequently happened. The strategy rested on the assumption that the Royal Navy would not have commitments in Europe, that it would not also be a European war. So when both Hitler and Mussolini are belligerents in Europe, that strategy also kind of falls apart. So when the invasion of Abyssinia in 1935 occurred, and then Hitler's reoccupation of the Rhineland happened, Hitler's intervention in Spain put Europe on notice that there could potentially be a war emerging there. The idea of there being a peaceful and secure Europe falls apart at the same time that there is potentially a war in Asia. Rangavan writes, "All this drastically and rapidly changed the context in which India's imperial role was considered. Italy could threaten imperial communications through the Mediterranean and the Red Sea, while Japan could menace imperial interests in the Far East and endanger India's coastline and shipping in the Indian Ocean. In consequence, the scope of India's external defence expanded to include the area stretching from Suez, Aden and the Persian Gulf in the west to Singapore in the east. An expert committee under Admiral Chatfield stamped its approval on this. India should acknowledge that her responsibility cannot, on her own interest, be safely limited to the local defence of her land frontiers and coasts." So the point that the British thought they were going to make to India is that it was irresponsible of India to not take on this strategic sphere from Suez to China. And the reason for that was not only would it affect the British Empire, but it would affect Indian security itself. That India's security began at the Suez Canal and ended at Hong Kong. Now, this might be the case, but it was a rather expedient way of getting India to do most of the heavy lifting in Asia. In London, there were military planners and strategists looking at a whole variety of different combinations of events and trying to second guess what might happen in the future. And in Delhi, there was the demands of internal security, making sure rebellions and uprisings didn't happen, the demands of keeping an eye on the northwest frontier and perhaps engaging a land war in Afghanistan with the USSR, and also the demands of keeping this gigantic crescent from Suez to Hong Kong secure. All a vast undertaking, and one which the British wanted to pay for as little as was possible and to put the financial burden onto India. And by 1942, at least two of these scenarios, internal uprisings in India and this broad strategic theatre from the Middle East to Southeast Asia, has fallen to India to grapple with. So India's war was extremely, extremely demanding on India. But as many historians have pointed out, India actually emerges from the war economically and industrially transformed, and also in terms of its military functioning and military prowess significantly altered as well. Anyway, thanks very much for listening, and I'm going to leave you there. You can find out more on our Patreon page. Check it out. There's all sorts of cool stuff there. And I'll put the link in the chat box below, or the thingy below. All the best. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.